Could the New York Stock Exchange have at last found a soulmate regulators can live with? From APM, this is the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich, and it is December 20th. We'll talk also about a critical patent rejection for Apple. We're going to talk about Americans' shifting views on gun control. Although there's a lot of talk right now, previous mass shootings have not moved the needle much. We'll also take a particularly marketplacey, poetic approach to the latest insider LIBOR rigging emails.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The New York Stock Exchange has been an independent company since basically 1792, but it does not want to be alone anymore. In recent years, the NYSE has attempted mergers with a German exchange and with the NASDAQ, but antitrust regulators scuttled both. This morning, NYSE Euronext says it has an $8 billion deal to be acquired by a futures trading company that's called Intercontinental Exchange. Marketplace's Queena Kim explains the urge to merge.
For nearly 200 years, when people think of Wall Street, they think of brokers shouting out trades on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange.
Listen, where are you going? Get back in there at once and sell, sell!
But that image is fading into the past. Christopher Whalen is with Carrington Investment Services.
The big board is kind of a wonderful antique, but in more recent years, most of the trading has gone away from the floor. It's conducted electronically.
And while the New York Stock Exchange mostly facilitates the trading of stocks, the big business these days is in derivatives, or complicated financial instruments like commodity futures and credit default swaps. Enter Atlanta-based Intercontinental Exchange, or ICE.
Now, the ICE is basically a derivatives exchange.
James Angel is a visiting professor at the Wharton School. He says what ICE is really after is the New York Stock Exchange's derivatives business in Europe. And analysts say today's news illustrates just how far the markets have evolved since the inception of the New York Stock Exchange more than 200 years ago. I'm Queena Kim for Marketplace.
The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has dealt Apple some bitter news. Apple had a pending patent claiming that it owned and originated the idea of pinching and zooming on our smartphones. That patent has been rejected. This complicates the outcome of the $1 billion judgment that a jury leveled against Samsung in August for violating Apple patents, including that one. James Besson is an economist who specializes in patent law at Boston University. Good to talk with you.
Thank you.
Why did officials decide that pinch and zoom was not a valid patent for Apple?
Someone submitted to the patent office some what's called prior art, which is mostly other patents that had been filed before Apple's. And that prior art, when they read it, when the examiners read it, seemed to cover what Apple's patent covered. So they decided either that the patent that they granted Apple was not novel, which is a requirement, or was obvious, which is another requirement.
So this kind of lines up with what I recall was the common sense being floated by many folks at the time during that trial, that people couldn't quite believe that Apple really came up with some of the patents in that case, including this one.
Right. This is the problem with software technologies in general, that there are a lot of very common ideas, a lot of these ideas overlap, and when you get the lawyers involved and it comes down to defining things in words, it's very hard to know where one patent starts and another one ends. So, for instance, the Apple patent talks about scrolling. One of the pieces of prior art talks about panning. Both things that you can do with your fingers on a touch screen. Is panning the same thing as scrolling? Well, it probably isn't exactly. Does panning include scrolling? Well, it probably does, but these things aren't clear.
So Samsung's supposed violation of the pinch and zoom pending patent was one part of the $1 billion judgment that went against Samsung this summer. What happens with that?
First off, this decision is just the first round at the patent office. Apple will almost certainly appeal it. But if this looks like it is holding up some months from now as the process proceeds, this may influence the judge in terms of reevaluating whether $1 billion in damages is the appropriate figure.
James Besson is an economist at Boston University. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And let's do the numbers. not much movement so far this morning. The Dow is essentially flat, sitting at 13,248. The S&P and the NASDAQ both basically flat as well, a few hours into trading. Shares of NYSE Euronext are sure moving, though, on the news of that likely acquisition we told you about. They are up more than 33% at the moment. Whoa. U.S. GDP has been revised up again for the quarter finished in September, and this time it shows the U.S. economy growing at an annual rate greater than 3%. But the data on business investment suggests we have slowed down since. U.S. jobless claims rose a bit last week after 4 weeks of declines. And last month, U.S. sales of existing homes hit the highest point in 3 years. A day after UBS announced a giant penalty for rigging the LIBOR interest rate, we continue to marvel over the brazen internal emails that were released along with the settlement. And once you get past the fact that these financial types are apparently atrocious spellers, there's something kind of poetic, I thought, to the back and forth. So I sat down this morning in a spare moment and plunked some of my favorite lines into some haiku for you. You scratch my back, yeah? Keep it as low as possible. Do that, I'll pay you. Try extra hard, mate. Think of me when you're on your yacht in Monaco. Go be a hero. You're bloody good at this game. Just be careful, dude.
Enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Since the Newtown shooting, gun makers have taken a beating on Wall Street. Big pension funds are threatening to divest. A big private equity fund is selling its stake in a major manufacturer. The Dick's Sporting Goods chain I just saw has voluntarily pulled certain kinds of guns from its shelves. And a presidential panel begins today to explore tighter gun control laws. But where does American opinion stand on that? Time for an attitude check.
And the latest poll number suggests
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said!
Attitude Check is our weekly partnership with the polling organization Gallup and its editor-in-chief, Frank Newport. Hi, Frank.
Good morning.
What's been the recent historical trend when it comes to support for stricter gun control?
We've generally seen a decrease, Mark, that a decrease in the percent of Americans who say they want stricter gun laws as each year has gone by. And the last decade, 13 years, unfortunately, have included repeating incidents of mass violence. But it doesn't seem to matter. We are now in our last asking prior to the shootings last Friday in Newtown, Connecticut, we were down to well below 50% of Americans who said they wanted more strict gun laws. So the trend has generally been down, down, down in terms of Americans' views of stricter gun laws.
And I know it's early yet, but are we seeing any changes in attitudes in the immediate aftermath of Newtown?
Yes, we are. I've been reviewing the evidence. We're actually updating our Gallup trend, but it's going to take a while because we want to make sure we do it on a long-term survey. A CBS News poll that went into the field very quickly after last Friday's shooting showed a big jump, actually 18 points to 57%. So yes, I do imagine we are going to see a short-term increase in the percent of Americans who want stricter gun laws. The real question will be how long that will last going forward.
What do Americans think would make a difference in preventing tragedies like this one?
Well, we were in the field this week asking about actions that could be taken to prevent school shootings, and banning assault weapons was actually fourth on the list. Number one would be increased police presence at schools. Government spending more on mental health was number two. Decreasing depiction of gun violence on television, movies, and in video games was third. And then banning the sale of assault or semi-automatic weapons was fourth. And 41% of Americans thought banning assault weapons would be very effective in stopping school shootings. So it's by no means at the top of the list.
Did you ask about this idea that has been out there that we should start arming teachers?
We did, and actually that was fifth on the list. The way we phrased it, and this is important, having at least one school official at every school carry a gun for the school's protection, 34% of Americans thought that would be very effective in stopping the shooting, and that compares to 41% who said it would be very effective to ban the sale of assault or semi-automatic weapons. So not a groundswell of support for the efficacy of that idea, but actually not that far below banning the sale of assault weapons.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief of Gallup. Thank you, Frank.
My pleasure to be with you.
The debate over American gun control is moving forward. Vice President Biden is on the case, and President Obama says he'll bring the issue before Congress in January. But whatever U.S. policymakers decide could also affect violence across our southern border. From the Fronteras Desk, Peter O'Dowd reports from Phoenix.
University of Massachusetts Amherst economist Aaron Dubay says the expiration of the U.S. assault weapons ban in 2004 put more powerful weapons into the hands of Mexican drug cartels. He co-wrote a paper on border violence this year.
Within months of the change in policy, we saw an uptick exactly where we would expect.
That's in Mexico, near border states like Arizona and Texas. Dubay says that violence was not as prevalent near California, where strict gun laws are still on the books. Even before this week's debate, gun advocates dismissed the role of U.S. gun policy in Mexico. Alejandro Hope, with the Mexican Institute for Competitiveness in Mexico City, says violence near the border has many sources.
Has to do with the shape and structure of drug markets, has to do with Mexican government policy.
And Hope says limiting the flow of guns to Mexico won't do much to reduce the demand that drug cartels have for them. In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
In Europe, the Catholic organization Opus Dei has gotten into a fight with a small Danish game maker. Now that row over a card game, evidently, has landed in court. From Copenhagen, the BBC's Malcolm Brabant explains.
Opus Dei, Existence After Religion, is a strategy-based game built around the world of philosophy. But the religious organization claims the company, Dima Games, has no right to use its name. Game inventor Mark Rees Andersen obtained copyright for the full name in 2009. He says Opus Dei, which means work of God in Latin, is a concept that has existed for centuries.
And it's preposterous to think that one organization can have the sole right to this concept, because if you have the right to define the work of God, then you also have the right to define God via his work, and that is insanity.
The organization is accusing Andersen of riding on the coattails of The Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown's award-winning book, which portrays the religious order as a sinister and sadistic sect. Opus Dei is demanding more than $50,000 in damages and wants the website where the card game is sold to be shut down. A verdict is expected in March. In Copenhagen, this is the BBC's Malcolm Brabant for Marketplace.
And as we wind down here, Boeing is working on giving passengers just what they want, which is Wi-Fi in more of their planes. But how all those signals behave inside an airline cabin is something we actually don't know that much about. And so naturally, they need to do some testing. Rather than haul a plane load of expensive human subjects in to sit in those seats and have Wi-Fi signals pass through them, Boeing has settled on a more cost-effective and maybe a safer, I don't know, alternative, potatoes. According to the LA Times, evidently sacks of potatoes reflect and absorb electronic signals much the same as human bodies. And while they do have eyes, they do not have arms to reach up and ring that annoying flight attendant call button. Just quickly here, before we close, a report from New Zealand, where it became December 21st, sooner than just about anywhere else. And they report this morning that the world has not, in fact, ended. To be fair, the Mayans never said exactly what time of day this would all go down. So I'm off for a few days. I'm getting out of here before the world ends, but the podcast will be in good hands, and I'll be back with you mid-part of next week. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.